It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
So I'm Lauren Regan. I'm the executive director and one of the senior staff attorneys at the Civil Liberties Defense Center. And we're a nonprofit legal organization that provides legal representation and support to progressive social change, climate, other left organizations, both in terms of like criminal representation. We defend grand jury resistors. We defend folks that are sued in slap suits when corporations sue activists. And then we also sue police and government agencies for violating people's civil rights and for unlawfully spying on social change organizations. And we've been around for a little over 16 years now. And we've defended over 3,000 activists for free around the country.
Well, we're just going to kind of dive into the subject material since we're so lucky to be able to talk with you today. But just to kind of start us out, you know, Christopher Wray, who's the director of the FBI, you know, he's said recently again and again, this is kind of a talking point that they've stuck to, that the FBI does not police ideology, and instead it, you know, goes after criminal activity. When you hear them say this, what is the response that immediately comes to you that they do not, quote, police ideology?
Well, I think history is the best teacher with regard to that issue, and you only have to look back in history to see very, very clear examples that that is not true. Look to the COINTELPRO time period, you know, the Red Scare, where literally leftist ideology was blatantly under attack at the highest levels. And COINTELPRO really has never stopped. You know, they got sued. They were told that it was unconstitutional to spy on political activists. They claimed that they shut down the program, but we know that that actually never occurred. And in fact, each administration, for the most part, has utilized its power and the power of the state to target those that dissent against it. And certainly our current era with the Trump regime is no different. Perhaps less sophisticated in its ability to try and cover it up a little better. You know, they've been pretty naked in their attempts at going after left ideology, but really nothing new. And I think, you know, the same is true if you look back historically. Most government officials, whether it's FBI or others, will never actually admit that that's what they're doing. You know, they're always able to cloak it in fancy words and other rationalizations, but it certainly doesn't, you know, negate the fact that, you know, if it quacks like a duck, it's a duck.
Is COINTELPRO the reason in which they are now presenting themselves as more of like a neutral player?
Well, I think any time a political machine like the FBI or the CIA or whatever agency you might be talking about, whenever they get blatantly caught, they attempt to learn from those mistakes and they learn to come up with better ways to mask what they're actually doing. But I would not say that it has really slowed down at all. You know, in fact, back in 2005 was when the Green Scare basically first began. And that was a situation where Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front underground activists were engaged in acts of economic sabotage between like 1997 and 2003. And there was no threat of harm or harm to actual human life. And the individuals involved had not gotten caught for almost a decade until one of their own, a person by the name of Jacob Ferguson, basically walked into an FBI office and offered to be a snitch. And they wired him up and sent him around the country to try to entrap his comrades. And the largest roundup of environmental and animal rights activists ensued. And in 2005, U.S. Attorney Alberto Gonzalez held a national press conference where he called these activists, who were allegedly innocent until proven guilty, but he labeled them as eco-terrorists on national media. And of course, this was at a time period where the U.S. government was actually unable to catch or apprehend individuals that were perceived as actual terrorists. You know, they were on the hunt for bin Laden at that time, and they couldn't find him. And they basically used the eco-terrorist moniker as a way to distract the American people from their impotence in actually finding quote-unquote real terrorists. And this was one of the first times that we saw a Department of Justice official using this kind of defamatory reference to individuals sort of based on political ideology at that time.
Huh. Well, you mentioned the Trump administration. I'm just curious, would you say that FBI tactics have changed at all under Trump when it comes to harassing or surveillance or just repression in general against people involved in social movements? Or have things remained pretty much the same?
You know, I get asked that question a lot. And I don't necessarily think that the level of repression against left-leaning activists has necessarily increased or decreased. I think for the most part, that type of repression, whether it's legislating new crimes, whether it's surveillance, infiltration, using the media, all of those tools and tactics have been pretty consistent in the 23 years that I've been defending activists. But one thing that I will say really has increased is the use of digital surveillance, the use of things like monitoring Facebook, Instagram, you know, other kind of social media platforms. That, you know, certainly has increased. And I think the other thing that has sort of changed or increased is the blatant use of like fusion centers, where you've got state and federal law enforcement and, you know, other law enforcement agencies working together. And often, you know, as we saw at Standing Rock, now you have the involvement of gray intelligence, these private security firms, you know, these corporate spies, also getting involved in the mix. And the significance of that is when you're talking about law enforcement, they actually have a rule book. You know, there are parameters on what they are lawfully allowed to do or not do. And for the most part, they want to try to stay within those bounds, because if they go outside them, it jeopardizes the ability for the situation to get into court. You know, if they go beyond those bounds, lawyers like me will file motions to suppress evidence and possibly, you know, get evidence thrown out and get charges thrown out. And so especially at the federal level, usually law enforcement agencies are pretty careful to not at least leave a trail of their actions that might go outside of the attorney general guidelines and the law. But with private spies like Tiger Swan and some of these others, they're not held to those same rules. In fact, they generally operate on the idea, you know, that they will do whatever they can until they get caught. And especially in the case of Tiger Swan, you know, we've seen FOIA documents that basically admit that their operatives broke into water protector dwellings and stole documents and records. And then importantly, they took that stolen information and they turned it over to law enforcement to aid in investigations. And so you've got these private spy agencies with no bounds, basically, until they actually get caught, handing over the goods that they illegally obtained to law enforcement. And then law enforcement, at a minimum, having access to that information and that intelligence, they may not use it to, you know, they would probably need more than that if they were going to bring it to court, because obviously it would come out. The chain of custody of where that evidence came from, but they still read it, they have it, they talk to each other. And that is something that, in my experience, is new, you know, over the last several years, and has really been sort of green lighted in the Trump administration.
Would it be fair to say that the FBI looks favorably upon, like, the growth of Tiger Swan as, like, an auxiliary security force that obviously played a huge role in, for instance, Standing Rock?
Well, not only that, but FBI and agencies like Tiger Swan basically have a revolving door where many of those private gray intelligence entities are staffed by former FBI agents. And many of them will leave the FBI, go work for these private agencies and make a ton of money, and then they'll go back into the FBI for some stint of time.
Oh, wow.
But they certainly are, you know, buddy-buddy, they're former colleagues. These former FBI agents and officials certainly know, you know, have been trained by the FBI. You know, maybe they can make calls to their buddies and say, hey, would you run this person? Or, hey, can I come play on the computers with you? Or, you know, whatever. But for sure, there is a revolving door between federal law enforcement and many of these private security intelligence agencies. And that's deeply problematic, significantly akin to the other revolving doors we're seeing in the Trump regime regarding the EPA, HUD, you know, Department of Education, where you see these corporate hacks going in and running these federal agencies, basically trying to defund them and destroy them, mm-hmm. and then returning back to Exxon or whatever corporation they came from to regain their monetary benefits.
Right, because, I mean, we've pointed this out on this program before, but when you get a job like that, like you've mentioned, I mean, to most of us it would be great money, you know, like over $100,000 a year or something like that, but, you know, it's nothing compared to what they would make, like you said, when they cycle back into the private sector and they're making, you know, millions and millions of dollars. But, yeah, just joining and then basically deregulating and destroying and, you know, breaking apart these institutions that are trying to create some sort of minimal oversight of what corporations can do and then cycling back into the private sector to reap the benefits of that. I mean, it's a smart move on their part.
Well, and I think, you know, the other thing to know too is obviously law enforcement, federal law enforcement and the Department of Justice has a lot of discretion regarding who they're going to investigate and who they're going to take enforcement action against. And if you're buddy-buddy with these private entities that are literally breaking the law to spy on political activists, then, you know, they're basically not going to open investigations or open prosecutions against their friends. And so these people, these individuals are operating, you know, with immunity, basically. You know, they are really not even worried about consequences to themselves. CLDC is currently working on a major upcoming federal case where we're kind of calling it the next gen COINTELPRO litigation, where we're actually going to take on the issue of private spies working with government spies to violate activists' constitutional rights, particularly climate defenders.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, is there any attempts at litigation against the involvement of people like Tiger Swan? You know, we could do a whole podcast on this, and in fact, we've talked about really trying to talk about Tiger Swan in particular, but would it be fair to say also that the people in law enforcement or the FBI would look at somebody in Tiger Swan not only as like a friendly face, but also somebody that could engage in things that, for instance, you said if they did, that they it might come back around to bite them in the butt?
Well, absolutely. You know, and you're right to not get caught up in a single name like Tiger Swan, because many of these agencies change their names as often as they change their socks. You know, today they're Tiger Swan, tomorrow they're Rabbit Duck, you know. So it makes sense to not get hung up on the actual corporate names, because, you know, for instance, as many of these operatives are outed for violating the law and for, you know, basically instigating violence, they are being banned from different states, like Louisiana, for instance. They're not allowed to operate in certain states. So they just basically reform themselves as a different entity and attempt to, you know, kind of change some of the individuals around so that they can basically continue with business as usual.
Just kind of moving forward, you know, one of the other things we wanted to talk about, and we've touched a little bit on this, but, you know, the way the media presents things, of course, and this is in the mainstream media, and especially also in kind of like the DNC-aligned, more centrist liberal media like MSNBC or CNN, has kind of presented this worldview of the FBI and the Trump administration as being at odds with each other. This is mostly in terms of like the Mueller investigation and stuff like that. Would you say there's any reality to that? Has the FBI seen the Trump administration as a friend or an opportunity to expand itself into different, you know, avenues of everyday life? Have they seen it as kind of like a wild and crazy group of people that are destabilizing the country? Or are they just seeing it as another administration? It doesn't really matter. I mean, are you seeing any patterns at all in that?
You know, I mean, I think politics make strange bedfellows, as that saying goes. You know, I certainly don't agree with the, idea that this particular FBI is a kinder, gentler FBI. You know, I think that politicians use anything and everything, to whatever advantage they think they can get. And, you know, personally, there's not a huge distinction from a lot of those centrist Democrats and their Republican colleagues anymore. So, you know, I think a lot of them are, you know, more interested in capitalism and maintaining capitalism than a lot of other things. And although I think that, you know, the current version of the FBI has been getting a lot of attention for, you know, investigating, the Russians and all these other issues, they're still doing all the other types of investigative work that they have done against, left-leaning activists as well. You know, for instance, we represent Sophia Wolanski, who is the young woman who had her arm almost blown off by cops at Standing Rock. And the FBI continues to claim that she's under investigation for blowing herself up. So, you know, I don't see any distinction really from one administration to the next with regard to the FBI. You know, sometimes the directors of the FBI will be cozier with a particular administration than others, but, you know, whether it is the Obama administration or the Trump administration, the FBI has a lot of continuing investigations and cases that just go from one to the other.
Well, you know, when Trump came into power, there seemed to be an initial push to, in a lot of states, to criminalize certain protest tactics, whether it was trying to pass laws or criminalize things like freeway blockades more so, or the wearing of masks, allowing people in their cars to, like, hit protesters on the roadway. You know, we're going to talk a little bit about, like, the specific targeting of water protectors in a second, but based on kind of like that initial push we saw, like, in 2017, were a lot of those attempts, did they go through in the end? Were they defeated? Was it kind of a mixed bag?
I would say that most of them did not end up going through with them. But the ones that may have actually passed, you know, what we have seen historically and what we're seeing currently is very often, even those, you know, blatantly unconstitutional bills that are passed into law, they will intentionally not use those laws to prosecute activists because they know that they will be challenged constitutionally and likely overturned. And so I think it really exposes the true intention behind this type of bill or this type of law, which is basically to chill people's rights. You know, they want to scare people away from becoming activists or for advocating for certain causes or, you know, going out onto the streets or, you know, whatever it may be. There are already multiple crimes on the books that could be adequately used to prosecute activists for most of the things that they get into. There is no need for any additional laws to be passed in this regard. The only reason you see laws like the riot boosting law in South Dakota, or, you know, some of these anti-masking laws, which, by the way, you know, have been going on for almost 20 years. You know, laws like that have been passed in various states and municipalities. But, you know, the reason for that is far more political than based in a need for community safety, for instance. I would just add to that that back in 2006, I think it was, is when the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act was passed. Mm-hmm. And this was an ALEC model piece of legislation, you know, American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a right-wing think tank made up of some of our, you know, the largest multinational corporations in the country and in the world. A lot of fossil fuels, prison industry, tobacco, you know, all the bad guys are, you know, pay a bunch of money into ALEC. ALEC comes up with legislation for the interests of its members and then basically buys legislators through lobbying and other things to get them passed. And ALEC and its comrades have had a plan for probably the last 20 or more years to really target state legislatures where there is less sophistication, less oversight, less attention to pass a lot of these types of laws. And ALEC, you know, pushed this, originally it was Animal and Environmental Terrorism Act, which basically made it a federal crime of terrorism to hinder the profits of an animal enterprise if used in interstate commerce, which includes online, you know, using the internet. And, you know, a number of years went by where this law was not used. And in fact, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a civil action challenging the constitutionality of the AETA, and the case was thrown out because the court said that they didn't have adequate standing because nobody they were representing had actually been prosecuted under the AETA yet. And of course, you know, the AETA was also one of those unneeded laws because burglary, trespass, criminal mischief, you know, all of those underlying things that could potentially be animal enterprise terrorism were already covered by all these other laws. Right. But it was a gift to big pharma and big ag. You know, it was basically a gift to particular industries. And, you know, at that time, pharma and factory farms were kind of the darlings that were pushing their weight around. I think right now, you know, we are definitely seeing the fossil fuel industries, oil and gas, you know, coal, et cetera, making that same kind of push where they realize that the moral compass is swaying away from them, that the majority of Americans are turning away from thinking that billions of dollars in profits and dirty drinking water is a good deal for them. And so as they lose that moral appeal, they double down and they're investing billions and billions of dollars to try to maintain this air of legitimacy. And you see them investing that money in things like these private spy agencies and media and legislation. And when you see them, you know, pushing laws like running down protesters in the streets, really what you are seeing them try to do is buy legislation that they hope will influence mainstream America to think, oh, well, if Congress, you know, or my state legislature is passing this law, one side must be good, the other side must be bad. I'm going to side with what I view simplistically as the good guys. So I'm going to be against my own interests and against water protectors, for instance. So, you know, that's kind of a classic example of, you know, the use of legislative repression as a tool against activists. And that is definitely nothing new. The targets change, and of course, you know, the specifics change. But, you know, a couple of things that I would say about it is this, as a tactic of capitalists and the far right, has never been effective because activists already know that if they engage in certain activities, they risk arrest and prosecution for crimes, sometimes felony crimes as well. You know, when the ELF engages in economic sabotage and commits arson, they know that they are risking an arson prosecution. So if Congress wants to, you know, pass some eco-terrorism, blah, 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 that is not going to deter individuals from committing those acts because they're already willing to risk arrest. It really doesn't matter what the label is on the criminal conviction. And in general, you know, even with the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act or, you know, these terrorism enhancements that were added to the Green Scare defendants, ultimately the time they spent in jail was not much different than what they would have done for prison time had they only been convicted of arson or, you know, some other mainstream crime. So the consequences, regardless of whatever new label they put onto the piece of legislation, also doesn't really change. So, you know, this is, I think, again, an act that is intended to bolster their base and to sort of kiss ass with their constituencies, and to potentially try to hold some kind of moral ground for those that actually, you know, respect that that framework. But I don't think that ultimately it is effective for them, especially over the longer haul.
Yeah, it also seems to be, in some ways, a way to just try to scare people in general, and not even, like, directed at militants that would engage in certain things, but just communities of resistance that would, you know, valorize and support those actions.
Yeah, I mean, that South Dakota law, the riot-boosting law that's currently being challenged for its constitutionality, actually specifically targets those that might provide financial support to organizations. So not only are they going after the frontline, you know, defenders, the frontline actors, but they're attempting to also target those that might send a donation to any one of those groups.
Or does that mean that, like, Samantha in Nebraska that shares a GoFundMe link could be targeted then because she is supporting riot boosting? I mean, it just seems like the opportunities are endless for somebody to be targeted under that law.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's, you know, just a pathetic piece of legislation that will, in my opinion, be absolutely overturned. Because, A, like you said, it's so broad and vague that the net is cast, you know, incredibly expansively. Anyone could basically fit in it. And, of course, number two, we know that there is not the law enforcement resources available on the planet to go after every person that puts $10 into a GoFundMe, you know, for somebody that's fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, that's certainly not a reality as well. So, you know, it is definitely meant to chill. It's definitely meant to sort of be a cheerleader for, you know, for the industry, for, you know, those that, you know, support the fossil fuel industry or that kind of profiteering. And I think because in that case, it is so blatantly unconstitutional, it's having little to no effect on the ground with regard to climate defenders, whether they're in South Dakota or not. But, you know, the flip side is that there are certainly some organizations, some of the bigger, you know, green organizations that see legislation like that as sort of the first, you know, throw across the bow, as they say. They see it as sort of a foreboding indication of things to potentially come in the future. And, you know, I think when you combine that with energy transfer partners' frivolous attempt at suing a bunch of those groups in that slap suit that we won a few months ago.
Right.
You know, and they tried to go after groups for RICO, you know, racketeering. You know, there is a very consolidated effort. You know, I think that's the bummer about this situation is that the far right and the capitalists have the time and the money to come up with this long-term plan that they are able to very fully fund. And so what we've seen over the last 5 or more years is actually kind of the tip of the iceberg of this larger endeavor that has been undertaken over the course of, you know, over a decade. And it's extremely far reaching, you know, to the point that, you know, some of these industries, some of these far right capitalist industries are giving textbooks to school systems, teaching, you know, their ignorant perspective, you know, on climate change, you know, on all sorts of things, on the creation of the planet and the solar system, you know, Big Bang, et cetera, et cetera. So they have really kind of thought things out in a much more systemic way than perhaps the left has had the time and patience to do. And so we are now sort of fighting battle after battle to sort of do first aid and triage while they are going about a much more systematic, orchestrated plan that we are being forced to be reactive to, I think, in my opinion.
Prove.
Well, I wanted to turn now to Fusion Centers, which you brought up a little earlier. We did a podcast on here with a couple journalists and other people that touched on Fusion Centers, and we've released a lot of stuff. Some of that revolved around a lot of FOIA documents that have been released. And if you go back and you look at some of this stuff that are coming out of these Fusion Centers, and you see things like... you know, law enforcement agents like sharing emails talking about, you know, investigating George Soros for, you know, working with drug cartels and anarchists to fund, you know, whatever, you know, just crazy out there stuff. I think one good example is the way in which the Antifa Civil War that kind of started off being promoted on sites like InfoWars kind of blew up. And if you look at the Fusion Centers, them taking it seriously, I think a lot of people have asked us, and this is something I wanted to ask you, is just that, like, not only just how can some of these, because obviously the FBI is involved in Fusion Center, the work that goes on there, how can agents that have, like, had a lot of training, supposedly are pretty intelligent and, like, have a grasp of what's going on in the country, at the same time either kind of exist in the same space where people are consuming like far right media and conspiracy theories and taking it seriously, and just people kind of want to know, like, you know, are they really kind of that dumb to just fall for that, or are they just sympathetic to it? It just seems kind of counterintuitive that you know, that law enforcement continuously buys into some of the stuff that comes out of the far right, which is just obviously crap.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that law enforcement as an institution is generally authoritarian, you know, is generally fascist leaning. And, you know, I don't think all cops are necessarily racist or in alignment with, you know, white nationalist or that type of ideology. But there certainly are facets of those law enforcement agencies that very much are. And unfortunately, you know, because of the blue wall of silence, those that, you know, may disagree with cops that have bought into that ideology, you are not going to out them. They're not going to, you know, come forward and address them. And in fact, I think, you know, we have seen historically that racist factions in law enforcement agencies often operate akin to, you know, violent gangs, where they kind of threaten and imply, you know, extraneous violence against individuals that, you know, may actually out them. You know, I think we've seen this around the country, whether you're talking about, you know, Portland, where cops were, you know, photographed being chummy with Proud Boys and you know, and other alt writers. But I think more systemically, you know, again, cops have a lot of discretion as to what they investigate and how and why. And I think that if they have sympathies or leanings toward that type of ideology, they are able to cloak it in a semblance of legitimacy and utilize their power to steer investigations in a way that they personally would prefer. You know, for instance, in Oregon, there is a sheriff in Clatsop County that has blatantly told its deputies to basically stop and attempt to arrest people that they perceive as potentially being quote unquote illegals. And the Oregon Department of Justice, AG's office, actually sent the sheriff a cease and desist letter saying, stop violating our sanctuary law. You know, you're violating state law. Stop. And apparently he has just kind of thumbed his nose at that and basically has said, I'm with Trump. And, you know, I don't give a shit about Oregon's sanctuary law. I'm going to do Trump's bidding and basically work as a tool of ICE in Clatsop County, where there are, you know, a lot of fisheries and canneries and things like that that utilize undocumented labor historically. And so there are a lot of people who are feeling targeted by that. And this is, you know, again, one of those rogue cops, similar to like Sheriff Arpaio down in Arizona, that basically uses his own ignorance and bias and hate, and then uses his position of power. And, you know, to me, I think the question is, you know, why isn't he not thrown out of office by the taxpaying citizens of that community, and replaced with someone with ethics? And, you know, that's kind of probably a topic unto itself regarding, you know, apathy. And, you know, I think a lot of people just basically feel neutered of any ability to make change in our communities right now, especially when law enforcement, you know, is the only professional entity in our country that literally has the legal powers to kill humans. You know, they are, they have unprecedented power in that regard, and they threaten it and they utilize it. And it's scary to a lot of people.
Well, I wanted to turn now back to the topic of people involved in fighting pipelines, water protectors. This seems to be one area that politicians have really pushed hard, or maybe more realistically, industry has pushed hard and politicians have answered. But, you know, in some states now, it's a felony to engage in any sort of protest activity or seemingly even like step foot on a construction site where a pipeline or other oil infrastructure or energy infrastructure is being constructed. Do you think any of these laws can be defeated, or is this going to be increasingly become the norm?
Well, I mean, again, I think that when you see those types of laws, you should say, you know, when I give trainings to activist groups, you know, I talk about the billions of dollars that the fossil fuel industry is currently spending and has literally labeled climate activists the number one threat to the survival of their industries. And I, you know, always tell people, you know, give yourself a round of applause for being really successful, you know, as volunteer ragtag, you know, normal people. You're the number one threat to the entire global fossil fuel industry and its billions of dollars in profits. And so when you see, you know, laws targeting climate defenders, you know, you should basically pat yourself on the back and say, you know, this is one, you know, an example of the last gasping breaths of an industry that is going down and knows it, and is basically doubling down and exerting all of its resources to basically trying to survive at this point. and trying to, you know, win a media war and, you know, win these other things. So I definitely think that the overreaching that a lot of those laws, you know, have very obviously done, you know, we always love it when activists are charged with these new crimes because it gives us a fast, cheap way to challenge the constitutionality of them. You know, if we have to sue them in civil court, we have to pay filing fees and it takes forever. But in the criminal context, there's like due process rights and speedy trial, and we can still challenge the constitutionality of these laws, both on their face and as applied to activists. And, you know, over and over again, we see those challenges being successful in the courts, even in, you know, fossil fuel or pipeline laden communities. You know, the blatancy with which these laws are unconstitutional basically makes it untenable for judges to not rule in our favor. And then those laws are stricken from the books. And, you know, and I think that has been the trend that we've certainly seen around the country, particularly regarding pipeline battles and fossil fuel industry. And that's not to say that climate defenders aren't getting arrested, prosecuted, and convicted for the run-of-the-mill stuff, like disorderly conduct or trespassing. But whenever we see people being targeted with those critical energy infrastructure laws, like in Louisiana and other places, very often what you will see is the state is going to offer some slap on the hand plea bargain, like plead to, you know, violation disorderly conduct, or take a no prosecution diversion agreement, where the deal is too good for the activists to say no to it. So they end up taking a plea bargain, which ends the case. And so that critical energy infrastructure law kind of still stays on the books because it wasn't able to be challenged because the activists decided to get back out on the front lines to, you know, continue their work without the threat of a protracted courtroom battle that could potentially result in, you know, felony convictions or consequences, which certainly are more serious than misdemeanors or violations.
Well, now I kind of wanted to turn towards the kind of the conversation that's been erupting over this so-called, you know, Antifa resolution pushing towards domestic terrorism. So it's interesting. There was a petition that was launched in 2017 by a far-right troll online named Microchip that was put forward as a White House petition right after Unite the Right, and it got over 100,000 signatures, and actually the White House responded to it and basically said, you know, basically nothing. So some of the stuff that we've even been saying, that, like, you know, we don't police ideology, you know, there are laws in place to deal with illegal activity. You know, basically we're ignoring this. And then, actually Enrique Tarrio, the leader of the Proud Boys, in June put another petition forward to label anti-fascist a domestic terrorist organization. It only got 41,000 signatures. It actually failed to even get the amount to get answered by the White House, but it was picked up by Ted Cruz and another senator, turned into a non-binding resolution. And then Trump has now tweeted about this. So I'm just curious, you know, what do we make of this? What do we make of this kind of noise that Ted Cruz and Trump have made about pushing to label anti-fascists as domestic terrorists?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's a distraction. You know, I wonder what kind of shit's happening behind the curtain that they're trying to, you know, kind of shake this little shiny toy over on the right and say, hey, look over here. Because, you know, it's really a pathetic joke. You know, not only is it a non-binding resolution, but it seems wacky that they would attempt to push for any kind of label for anti-fascists, because, of course, you know, we all know that, you know, if somehow anti-fascists were to be labeled that, then absolutely fascists would be labeled that. You know, I mean, anti-fascists haven't killed anyone, you know, unlike the far right, where, you know, I think the Anti-Defamation League, you know, put out the number that far-right extremists were responsible for 73% of extremist murders in the U.S., you know, in the last 10 years. The only other group of people that they really counted in that was jihadists, which, you know, I think comprised the rest of it. So, you know, anti-fascists aren't even on that scale at all. So it seems kind of perilous that, you know, an idiot like Cruz would poke the bear and say, hey, let's label this group that hasn't killed anybody a domestic terrorist group, since I'm the, you know, puppet for, you know, the other side of the equation that has been responsible for a bunch of documented murders of humans, including Heather Heyer and many other people. So, you know, I think it's pathetic. And, you know, it's not even, you know, we've been getting lots of calls lately, like, is this a crime? You know, what is this? This is just puffery. You know, it is just not even worth the paper that it's written on. I expect that it's some kind of ploy by Cruz and the Louisiana, you know, co-sponsor of it to basically, you know, give a gift to who they view as their constituency. Yeah. You know, and Cruz, you know, it's additionally pathetic for him because, you know, we were actually just having a discussion not long ago. And, you know, I mean, Cruz may be being used by the far right right now, but he would be a target of them, you know, the day after tomorrow, you know, as a POC person with a Latinx name, you know, and the same with Torreo and, you know, some of the other Proud Boys that they kind of push in front of the cameras, like, those individuals, you know, are being used in, you know, in a pretty flagrant way, because the people pushing them from behind, you know, would likely consider them, you know, part of the problem as well.
There was a recent article in the Washington Post that was published that was pretty interesting, but it stated it was like an ex-agent saying that there's a feeling within the FBI that they are scared to go after the far right and white nationalists because they don't want to upset Trump's base.
Yeah, I mean, I would interpret that in this way. You know, the FBI has to bring those investigations to the Department of Justice, you know, to the Trump, you know, appointed lawyers in order for there to actually be prosecutions or enforcement action. And so if Bill Barr or whatever ding dong is, you know, sitting on the seat for a given day or week, is basically saying, don't bring me this, I'm not going to prosecute it because I'll be the target of Trump's tweets and he'll kick me out, then it makes no sense for the FBI to exert any effort, you know, or put hours into the investigations that they know are going to be turned down by the higher ups that are in charge of actually bringing things into the courtroom, you know, and into, you know, and to bring them to justice. I think that, for long-term FBI agents, and for a lot of like the national security personnel, you know, they have been much more, eyes open regarding like U.S. neo-Nazi groups and their ties to, foreign extremist groups. You know, I think about, National Action, you know, the UK, neo-Nazi group. You know, the UK designated that group as a terrorist organization back in 2016. You know, kind of the first time that they had, flagged a far right group since like World War II or something like that. So a pretty significant act by the UK. And some of the researchers in the UK basically identified links between National Action and a number of US neo-Nazi groups, including like Vanguard America, that James Alex Fields was a member of, you know, and Fields was the guy that crashed into
the march that Heather Heyer was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there are people within the investigative branches of our government that are aware of where the real threats are, and they are deeply frustrated by kind of the bullshit that's going on, you know, in the White House and in mainstream media, because those two entities, you know, work together. I don't think that it stops those more serious researchers from knowing and understanding and doing their jobs behind the scenes. Like, I think that work is going on. They know exactly what's going on in the U.S. in terms of the far right extremist groups and their propensity for violence against humans and stuff like that. They're just not gonna get, you know, a story in the mainstream media. And they're afraid of being targeted by the White House and driven out of their careers, you know, by this fickle idiot. So I think a lot of the more serious people are trying to keep their heads down to the extent that they can. But I think it would be naive to think that they weren't fully aware of the true picture. And, you know, I think historically there is, you know, the facts and the truth. And then there is the way the current political moment wants to spin it for their own instant gratification. And that's sort of what I view a lot of this as.
And also in the past, I mean, like with the Oklahoma City bombing, which was carried out by Timothy McVeigh, who definitely came out of the white nationalist and the militia movements. You know, after that, they made a decisive effort to kind of go after that stuff. But I think that was only after somebody basically decided to kind of come into their world and attack their infrastructure and stuff that they cared about, you know, a federal building. I also think it, the FBI, it seems like after that ProPublica piece came out about Adam Waffen and like the Rise Above movement, kind of like, you know, why hasn't anything been done? It seems like they've responded to, or they've attempted to respond by kind of like going after like easy stuff. Like, here's a bunch of guys that are obviously on camera that like beat a bunch of people up at Charlottesville. Kind of responding to like a destroyed lack of legitimacy because, you know, definitely a lot of people are asking like, you know, what the hell? Like, why aren't you going after these people? Like, everybody can see what they're doing. And they seem to have done a little bit about that, but I don't know, just a very interesting, it's an interesting world. I mean, there was just a report that was put out that was talking about like QAnon and essentially like pro-Trump conspiracies being, you know, a possible kind of like breeding ground for, domestic terrorism. And I mean, that's something that's being like, you know, literally promoted by the presidency. Like, there's a pro-Trump conference that's happening in Florida in a couple months that, you know, Huckabee Sanders is going to be speaking out along with like Jack Posobiec and like literally like flat earthers and people that are into QAnon. I mean, it's a bizarre time to be alive for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, important to understand the legal framework for all of this. You know, there is no, in the United States, there is no domestic terrorism statute. You know, there is no domestic terrorism law. You know, the State Department can designate a group as a terror group, but their definition is that primarily, they do work, you know, they work overseas, which is why these foreign groups that have affiliates in the U.S. is interesting, because there actually is a pathway, that is available to the feds under that rubric. But in the U.S. domestically, we don't have a domestic terrorism law at all. in, you know, in 2001 when the Patriot Act was passed, they created a definition of domestic terror, but that definition is only used by the FBI to open investigations. And that definition basically was violent acts or acts dangerous to human life that violate federal or state law that are intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population or to influence government policy. The other thing that we have under U.S. law is we have a terrorism enhancement under the U.S. sentencing guidelines, and that's what was used against our Green Scare cases, which means the individuals were convicted of the crime of arson. But if the state argued that the intention of their violent act, arson, was to influence the policy of government, you know, for instance, they were going after horse slaughter, you know, rounding up wild horses on federal land. So the government basically argued they were attempting to influence government policy by using arson as a tactic. Then they can get this sentencing enhancement, which only focuses on punishment, you know, adding years to someone's prison sentence. And, you know, kind of putting a label on their conviction, but it's not actually a crime itself. The only other thing that the U.S. can currently do is designate an organization like Adam Waffen as a hate group. And many, many far-right groups are, you know, labeled as that. And that basically, you know, gives the FBI and other law enforcement agencies increased funding and resources to investigate, infiltrate, you know, surveil those particular groups. And if they're prosecuted in state courts, then they can, you know, also get a sentencing enhancement for conducting hate crimes.
We'll be right back.
Well, that kind of brings me to my next question, is that after, you know, the tragic events of last weekend, the FBI, I believe now, has put out a statement or a memo basically saying, like, allow us to designate groups as domestic terrorists. And, you know, I think a lot of, especially like liberals and people in the center, are kind of applauding this. But what a lot of people have also pointed out is, like, look, like, if we allow the FBI to basically have this power to basically label groups domestic terrorists, like, the, you know, they're going to spend a lot more energy going after groups on the left or social movements than they will the people that are, you know, actively trying to mass murder members of the public.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, historically, that slippery slope has always harmed the left more than the right. So, you know, I think that any kind of designation like that, even if, you know, in this very moment they're talking about going after right-wing extremists, will only open the door, you know, for it to be used on anyone that dissents against the Trump regime. You know, that's much more likely what will happen, is that, you know, Trump and its administration will basically attempt to use it to shut down any kind of protest or dissent against it, you know, it itself, which, of course, you know, is a very classic game plan for fascism.
Do you think that they will get that?
Well, I would say that my crystal ball would say that I don't think that's likely to happen, because they already have mechanisms that exist that basically allow them to have that kind of outcome. Although, you know, I will say that some of the things that I hear coming out of those centrist Democrats, you know, like Pelosi and others, definitely do not seem well advised, and seem knee-jerky, without a lot of context, historical context or understanding. You know, and those groups would just as like, you know, that middle road would just as likely turn on us as they would turn on the right. So, perilous.
This has been a great conversation. We could really continue, but we've been talking for a while. You know, earlier on you brought up kind of this feeling, you said, where we're kind of like, you know, running around and trying to like put out all these fires and stuff, whereas they have kind of a long-term strategy. Can you leave us with the hope in which, you know, social movements can come up with more of a long-term strategy? You know, how do you see things going into the future? There seems to be like a worry with Trump in office and kind of like a lot of this stuff, like legally speaking, kind of like reaching a point of no return, or that there would be, you know, something passed or something happens in which, you know, there is like a huge turn in that, you know, even the facade of like checks and balances and the democratic state kind of goes out the window. And I'm just curious, you know, how you see things in the future, and if you do see things that movements can do to kind of like push back against just kind of running around putting out fires and starting to develop a long-term strategy ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a topic that could definitely be its own show. But I think that in, you know, in building a mass movement where there is more of us than them, you know, we need to kind of come full circle back to our origins. You know, I think there are a lot of things that unite the majority of people, like the need for clean water. You know, that whole theme of water is life at Standing Rock, I thought, was really powerful, because it was able to mobilize labor unions, religious groups, you know, people of every race, every economic status, because that is something that is common ground. Similar to, you know, most people as the status of workers. You know, when I'm in like rural Montana or rural locations, picking juries and talking to juries, you know, for climate cases, very often, you know, I'm talking to them about being workers and safety and their families and, you know, the fact that, like, labor unions were considered the original environmentalists because they lived close to the factories with their families and drank that water and had, you know, real stake in the game in terms of trying to, you know, protect themselves and their families. I also would just kind of briefly say that I feel like social media and in particular Facecrack has basically just been an incredible poison to our society and especially to organizing. The fact that, you know, most people think of their activism as clicking buttons and liking other people's posts instead of getting out there and meeting their neighbors and having face-to-face conversations and building trust and, you know, really kind of taking care of each other, that has sort of fallen by the wayside. And I think there are a number of perils involved in, you know, both the reliance and the addiction on social media, not to mention the fact that, you know, as so many people have written about now, it's just fraught with the ability to amplify division and, you know, and lead to extremism in a lot of different ways. I think that the existence of social media and its, you know, advent in the last decade or two has really changed a lot of things, especially with regard to social justice organizing. And, you know, I think that we on the left get easily fractured into smaller and smaller groups and ideologies as compared to often the right. And I would love to see, you know, more of that come together. You know, I would love to see strategists and smart people and historians and thinkers and, you know, people from all different places, proverbially, you know, sitting around a table and really kind of figuring some of this stuff out over the longer haul. And I don't think that that has really happened for us. And that really needs to, you know, I remember back to sort of like 2008 during the Republican National Convention when the St. Paul principles were brought into existence. You know, that was a lot of work and a lot of effort by a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds, you know, as a consensus-based process to come up with a way to work together on the streets with regard to protest and, you know, not stepping on each other's tactics and not shit-talking each other's tactics. And I think, you know, it's a small example of what is needed over the longer haul. You know, I also think that as the realities become much starker regarding human survival and fights over resources and water and food and things like that, I think you'll see, you know, the lines being redrawn between the sides and the sides that need to feed their families and don't want to watch their children die of cancers and poisonings and lead, you know, lead in the drinking water and all of those other things. When you see those lines drawn, you know, very clearly, it really does become an us versus, you know, that 1% capitalist profiteer. And I think that over time, it's my hope at least that those lines become more evident and will allow for more powerful organizing. I think we really on the left need to take ourselves much more seriously, both in terms of our strategies and our pedagogy, our digital security, you know, the way we take care of each other and our communities. Like, you know, I think there are times in history where it's maybe slightly easier going for some activists, and it becomes sort of a social scene and ego gratification and, you know, let's go have a fun parade in a parking lot and call it a protest. And I think it's much harder work to figure out really truly effective strategies, to make change, real change on the left.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. Just to kind of sign us out, is there any way that people listening to this can support the work of the Civil Liberties Defense Center? And how should they go about doing that?
Sure. Yeah. Our website is cldc.org. We've got a lot of activist resources, ways to get on our newsletter, if you want. Know Your Rights trainings or other legal trainings, we do them in lots of frontline communities as well as online. So you can always request, support from us if you are left-leaning activists. We always try to be proactive. So before things hit the fan, we love to get involved with communities to help armor them, make them more resilient against state repression, whether that's corporate or government. The more you know in advance, the more effective you can be and the more resilient you can be against these types of acts. I think I would end by just saying, repression is nothing new. Movements have endured that in varying forms, including assassinations, historically. I think that you need to be smart and nimble. You need to know what the threats are against you and your movement, and you need to figure out ways to dance around them. And knowledge is power in that regard. And our organization really tries to help with that.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.